This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Charmaine Cozier. On The Inquiry this week, we're looking at unregulated wines and spirits, including fake alcohol. What makes them toxic and how widespread are they? The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, from Kenya, why is justice so slow in coming for the death of a baby girl killed by police in election violence in 2017? Anti-corruption campaigners in Nigeria are frustrated by a lack of transparency over what happens to stolen money retrieved from foreign countries.
So many countries are cooperating. The only challenge we have is the absence of transparency and accountability and the judicial use of these return funds by the Nigerian government. And that's what civil society have been pushing to say, look, we cannot go to international community and be advocating for the return of these funds and then this money disappeared again.
And will the new Trump administration recognize Somaliland, thereby becoming the first country in the world to do so? It's Monday, the 20th of January. First, we go to Kenya. The parents of a baby girl killed during post-election violence in Kenya in 2017 have told the BBC of their pain and frustration at delays in getting to the bottom of how and why their infant was killed. 12 police officers are facing charges of murder for the death of 6-month-old Samantha Pendo. They are also accused of torture and rape during an operation to deal with protests following a highly contentious and violent election. In a historic step, the Supreme Court in Kenya ordered that that election be rerun. It duly was, and President Uhuru Kenyatta won again, defeating Raila Odinga. Bitter protests followed in his strongholds in western Kenya, the city of Kisumu among them. Baby Samantha's parents have been waiting for someone to be held accountable for their daughter's death. The BBC's senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy has been following the case.
It is tragic. It was during the election of 2017 in Kenya. And as you know, election season is usually very packed with emotions. And Uhuru Kenyatta, the then president, was declared re-elected. That did not go down well in opposition strongholds. And so people went out to protest. One of the strongest opposition strongholds is Nyalenda informal settlement in Kisumu, that is in western Kenya, just by Lake Victoria. And police were deployed to deal with the protests. And these police, some of them went to a residential area, which was just near the road in Nyalenda. And we are told by the family of baby Samantha Pendo, who tragically lost her life that night of August 11th going into the 12th, that they heard the police officers breaking down their neighbors' doors, beating up some of them, and finally they got to their door. So they had barricaded their door from inside using furniture, but the police knocked, and then, you know, the father said, "We are a family of four, two children and two adults, please spare us." But the police would hear none of it. So they knocked on the door, they were kicking it, and finally they got a small space through which they threw in a tear gas canister. This is a one-roomed house, very small, and that forced the family to come out. And There was a six-month-old baby, Samantha Pendo. She was suffocating. And even before the family could plead, the father was ordered to lie down and he was being beaten. He says that he covered his head using his hands and they were hitting his hands with clubs. They were also beating the mother who was holding this baby who was suffocating. Lensa Achieng is Samantha Pendo's mother.
What did I hear the next time? The grip of my daughter holding me tightly as if she's in the pain. I said no. I turned her. What was coming outside his her mouth? It was foam. After seeing that, I had to go and rescue his dad because he was being beaten.
Those are chilling words from the parents of a little six-month-old baby from 7 years ago. And how have they been coping during this time?
It has been very difficult. They moved house because they said that, you know, the trauma was just too much. They couldn't live in the same house where their daughter had been attacked and lost her life. And every time this case has come up, they'd hoped that they would have justice by now. But even up to now, the charges have not yet been pressed against the suspects. There are 12 police officers who public inquest found culpable. They are yet to face charges of murder, as well as of rape and torture affecting around 60 other victims of the alleged police brutality from that time. And it's devastating for the family, as the husband and father told me, Joseph Abanja.
I'm crying out for my daughter to get justice that you deserve. We did as we told, vote, go home, relax, wait for the result. All I can say is that for Kenyans to make sure that justice has been served for my daughter. That's all. Thank you, guys.
And why has it taken so long for this family to get justice?
One of the lawyers who's representing the family and the other victims of that alleged police brutality believes that there is no political will to prosecute the officers who are found culpable in the public inquest. He is convinced, as are human rights activists, that the state is reluctant to press charges against these police officers. We put these questions to the Director of Public Prosecutions. His office is meant to be independent constitutionally, so he should not be taking orders from anyone. However, from his office, we heard that they could not deal with our request at this time. So basically, as accusations have been leveled against that office because the lawyers representing the victims, there were two instances last year in October and November when the accused were meant to take a plea. It is the DPP who applied for adjournment from the court. And so they said he's acting like an attorney of the accused rather than the prosecutor. So it's very frustrating for them. It's very frustrating for the victims.
Just bring us up to speed, Anne, with exactly what is the status of the 12 police officers that have been implicated in not just the death of the six-month-old Samantha, but also other cases around the actions that they took in Nyalenza that night.
They are yet to be formally charged. And as of 2022, the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions recommended that they be charged with murder, torture, and rape as crimes against humanity, which would be the first time in this country that the international crimes law is being invoked. However, they are yet to be charged more than 2 years later. And many are asking now, why this? Is it a lack of political will? And you can imagine the frustration of the victims, not just Pendo's parents, but also victims who lost their limbs, victims who were raped. They're yet to find closure.
So when people say there's a lack of political will, what is the government's response to this? Have they accepted responsibility for the slowness with which this is happening?
This case was brought to court by the Director of Public Prosecutions. And therefore, human rights activists that I spoke to, including Amnesty International, they are questioning why in the beginning it was the DPP that was pushing for this case. But then over the last 2-3 years, it appears that it is the same office that has shown some unwillingness to proceed with the case. The reason they sought adjournment from the court is because they say one accused person is at large. He has not yet been found. And the argument from the lawyers representing the victims is that in many instances, the accused can be charged together with others not present in court. It has happened in many instances. And therefore, it's baffling that it has taken this long.
Why are we talking about this now, Anne?
On Wednesday last week, there was supposed to be a third attempt at bringing the accused before court to face the charges and take a plea. However, that did not happen. But in this instance, it was the presiding judge who had been transferred to another station out of Nairobi, and therefore she has been replaced. And now it has been rescheduled for the 29th of January. And the human rights activists, as well as the lawyers, are hoping that this time round it will actually happen.
Senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy in Nairobi. We talk about corruption and the looting of state coffers a lot here on Focus on Africa. We look at the problem through the lens of those who steal and the impact it has on the people who are being stolen from. Today, we're looking at where the money goes and what happens when, after long legal processes, that money is returned from the vaults of foreign banks back to the country it was taken from. It's been happening in Nigeria with some regularity in recent years. The most recent case involves some $53 million, which the United States government is sending back. The money was recovered from the former oil minister, Jezani Alison Madueke, who was accused of accepting bribes for oil and gas contracts worth billions. So the $50 million plus is not a huge amount, but it is better than nothing. So what happens to the monies that do get repatriated? Nigerian authorities have promised to spend the money recovered from the former oil minister to bring electricity to rural areas. But will it happen? I've been speaking to Awal Musa Rafsanjani, the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center. He told me the return of the funds is not the problem. It's what happens to it afterwards. I began our conversation by asking how significant the return of this money was.
The return of this money is very significant given the socio-economic challenges that Nigeria is currently facing as a result of outright looting, stealing, the abduction of public asset by some public officials, which, you know, plunged the country into a more economic deterioration, more poverty, inequality, absent of infrastructure like electricity, like even roads and healthcare system that have virtually collapsed, as well as education.
It's a very small amount, though, in relation to the riches that Nigeria's oil sector produces. It's $52 million. I'm wondering, is this the first return of its kind?
No, there are several returns of loot abroad, right from 1999 in July, when, you know, $420 million was also recovered. In May 2022, $1.2 billion was also recovered. And there are several, you know, recovery were actually made from 1999 to date.
Is it specifically from the US or is it from other countries as well that funds have been repatriated?
From several countries. From several countries. You had some from the United States, some even from Switzerland, and some of these funds are also from the Britain. So there are quite a number of countries that are helping to return this money. This is because of the understanding or the agreement reached in December 2017, when there was a global forum on assets recovery, where certain principles were adopted by the global leaders to ensure return of stolen assets to the countries this asset were stolen.
How much money would you say since 1999 has been repatriated to Nigeria? And if that's too much to calculate, let's take a look at from 2017 then, when the Global Asset Forfeiture Forum happened.
There are huge amount of money that has been returned to Nigeria. In terms of the figures, there are actually a lot of figures, because even government is not able to give you exactly what they have received. This is part of the challenge of data and transparent information to the general public. So you can only have access to the information that, you know, is being put out there, especially by the countries that have returned this money.
So what happens to the money when it is returned? For instance, let's look at 5 years ago, the U.S. transferred $311.8 million U.S. dollars to the government of the day, and that the money was traced back to the Abacha regime from the 90s. So what has happened to that money?
So sadly, this money, when they are returned, there's no any transparent or accountable management of the utilization of this money. So you recover from this looter, and then a new set of looters either misappropriated or diverted or completely even re-loot the money. So this is what has happened. That was effort in the previous recovery during Buhari, when there was understanding that, okay, some of this recovery should go into capital project. But because of the budgetary system in the country is also shrouded by corruption and misappropriation and not even carrying out the project, that has not really come to any, you know, significant impact that you can see.
So you're saying that the money gets sent back, but it disappears into the hands and pockets of other looters, as you call them. So are there no checks and balances to ensure that the money is actually spent properly and not mismanaged in the process of it being transferred? Is there no oversight whatsoever?
Sadly, before 2022, we did not have any legal framework that could help to ensure, you know, management of recovered asset, whether local or international. But in 2022, you know, civil society advocated for the enactment of Proceed of Crime Act, which now supposed to be, you know, helping to ensure that the recovered assets are actually properly and documentary spent. But despite this, you cannot actually find out any data where recovered assets have been put to use for the benefit of Nigerians. So civil society have been advocating even for the improvement in the legal framework to ensure proper coordination, because there appears to be no proper coordination within the agencies that are recovering this asset, and therefore no information on what this project or what these resources have been used for the people, you know, of Nigeria.
So the 53 million or so that has been recovered in this latest case, the case involving Dizani Alison Madueke, do you foresee it disappearing into the pockets of people who are not entitled to have it? Or is it going to go to the electrification of rural areas as it's supposed to do?
We are lucky with the agreement reached between the United States of America and the Nigerian government is that there are two key specific areas where this money will be channeled, and a special trusted account will be opened, and this money will be managed by the World Bank. So we believe that since the United States is involved and the World Bank is involved, Nigerian government is involved, we believe that this money will not be diverted, you know, or looted as usual.
I'm interested in the process around which this happens and how long it actually takes. In the case of Dizani Alison Madueke, it seems like it was very, very quick. But in the case, for instance, of the Abacha regime and the billions that they had stolen, it took quite a long time. It was only returned about 5 years ago or so. So I'm wondering, what is the process? Does Nigeria, the Nigerian government, applies for the money, says this money was stolen, and then the money is repatriated quite quickly? Or are there other things that need to go into it before the money is actually sent back?
So actually, before December 2017 Global Forum on Asset Recovery, there was no much clear principles adopted and should be committed by all countries. So after that meeting in Washington, D.C., which I also happened to be part of that meeting as a civil society observer, it was agreed that there should be coordination, collaboration by the international community to facilitate the release of these funds. Since then, it became very much easy for Nigeria to get this money because the international community have been committed to those principles of helping to ensure that they remove some of the bottlenecks. So there's a mutual assistance, legal assistance to ensure that this money is actually quickly returned. And in the principle, it was also agreed that those who helped to facilitate the looting of the money, when the money is back, they should not benefit from it. So many countries are cooperating. The only challenge we have is the absence of transparency and accountability and the judicial use of these return funds by the Nigerian government. And that's what civil society have been pushing to say, look, we cannot go to international community and be advocating for the return of these funds and then this money disappeared again.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Awal Musa Rafsanjani, the Executive Director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, which is the Nigeria chapter of Transparency International. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sarah Chlevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1,000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Donald Trump is the new president of the United States. This is his second bite of the cherry, so we're taking a look at how his administration will deal with the intractable conflicts on the continent this time around. When we looked at Africa's prospects on New Year's Day, we discussed the impact of a Trump 2.0 presidency in general terms. When he was president from 2017 to 2021, Mr. Trump expressed some salty sentiments about African countries, and the relationship was lukewarm, to say the least. So what will things be like this time around? There are conflicts raging in Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, as well as the insurgencies across West Africa and Mozambique. And then there is South Africa and Somaliland, two countries that may be in the spotlight for different reasons. I've been hearing from Mvema Pezo-Dizolele, Senior Fellow and Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So, there are several wars blazing across the continent. One of the biggest ones is Sudan. What indication do we have that the incoming administration has Sudan on their radar?
I think past is present in many ways when it comes to international affairs. We will remember that the last time President Donald Trump was in the White House, he had engaged Sudan quite a bit, particularly because of the Abrahamic Accords. The United States needed Sudan to be part of the Abrahamic Accords in terms of getting a lot of the Arab countries to recognize Israel. That's where things were left off. And I anticipate the new administration will pick up from where they left off.
So let's talk about what's just happened with the Biden administration and Antony Blinken, who was the Secretary of State. How did that approach differ to what President Trump was doing then? And how will it influence what President Trump is going to do next?
The problem is that Sudan needs peace. And peace never came to Sudan, whether it was doing Trump one or doing the Biden administration. It is our hope in the policy analysis world, now that the U.S. has declared the crisis in Sudan a genocide and sanctioned both sides of the conflict, now that they have that on the record, engaging in genocide triggers certain reactions. We hope the United States will engage accordingly.
The former special envoy for the Sahel region, John Peter Pham, is expected to become the top Africa official in the new administration. Tell us a little bit about him.
Peter Pham is pretty well known in the Africa policy circles. We remember that he's an academic. He taught at James Madison University for a number of years and then was Africa director at the think tank called the Atlantic Council, where he wrote quite a bit on Africa. He later on became the special envoy for the Great Lakes and the DRC. Since leaving office, he has been engaged in a number of businesses, mostly sitting on boards of companies dealing with telecom and mining and so on. He's been busy on Africa. How will his approach differ? Well, he still needs to get appointed and be confirmed. That remains to be seen. Last time when Trump won happened, his name also was floated quite a bit as a potential Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. That did not happen.
It seems that Somaliland is going to be a big winner in relations with the new administration. Why are they so determined to have Somaliland recognized when, you know, around the world, governments have not been that interested in doing it?
I'm not sure if they're so determined to recognize it. That has not been the position of the United States. It remains to be seen what the Trump administration will do. In terms of the interests of the value that Somaliland represents, one is the location. We always say in real estate is location, location, location. They are right there wedged between Somalia, Ethiopia, Djibouti, that region of the Horn. So it will be seen as an alternative, or it's being seen as an alternative to Somalia, which is next door, which is still struggling with Al-Shabaab. Somaliland is somehow, somewhat better managed. It's been quiet for the most part. They've shown a level of organization that is attractive, but mostly the port of Berbera is one that is of tremendous importance to countries like the United States. The challenge is, what message will that send? Somalia is not happy with that. Somalia still considers Somaliland as part of their territory. But then you also have to take into consideration regional powers like Egypt that has said that they will send troops to support Somalia when it comes to Somaliland. So this is not a done deal at this point. We will have to wait because there are other dynamics and other interests that are also at play beyond just the recognition of it.
Then, of course, there's the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There's Mozambique and the Islamist insurgency there. Are there any indicators that the U.S. has any specific interest in getting involved in solving those conflicts?
America also recognizes that America first does not mean America alone. It's just not possible. The U.S. is a superpower, and the world expects the U.S. to lead. The DRC is front and center when it comes to what is known now as critical minerals in Washington, D.C. We see that the U.S. is heavily involved with the Lobito Corridor, which is now considered kind of the flagship investment program of the United States in Africa, trying to counter China. President Biden was just in Angola in December. So DRC being at the center, you know, the DRC and Zambia, this is kind of criticalminerals.com of the world. There is no way the U.S. will pull out in those engagements.
Let's talk about South Africa, because it has stuck its head above the parapet in concerning taking Israel to the ICJ. The last Trump administration put the squeeze on South Africa around its relationship with Iran. It seems to me that South Africa is not getting off on a good footing with the Trump administration. What do you think?
This is the relation that we all want to watch, meaning U.S.-South Africa relation, because South Africa is the largest economy on the continent, is the most functional economy on the continent, is one of the most influential countries on the continent. It's also the largest trading partner of the United States. The U.S. and South Africa have a different view of history. In the United States, a lot of people have come to believe that they helped South Africa free itself from apartheid. We know, of course, that's not how the South Africans see this. South Africa want to continue leading as a non-aligned country, taking a certain role in movement like BRICS and other platforms that are challenging the current world order. Their position on moral issues and other principles are typically opposed to those of the United States. So the Republican majority Congress is probably going to push hard on South Africa. The challenge is whatever approach the United States takes on South Africa will send certain signal to the rest of the continent, whether they should consider the United States as a real partner or as a bully. The ICJ case is one that is a thorny one because, again, the Republican majority Congress is aligned and allied to Israel. And the position that South Africa takes is a challenge to that. The other thing is the closeness or proximity of South Africa to Russia, to China, which the United States considers as its adversaries. But South Africa is an independent country with its own autonomous foreign policy. Time will tell as the administration comes on board how they will engage.
What do you think are the earliest signs we should be looking out for?
It's about who is appointed and who is appointed in all these agencies. Who's at the CIA, who's at the Ministry of Defense, who's the head of the Africa Bureau, and then the vision that President Trump lays out will also all come to bear. But, Audrey, we also have to account for other development in the world. Remember, just 3-4 years ago, Ukraine was not a major issue. Then it became a major issue in relations between the United States and African countries because African countries voted a certain way vis-a-vis Ukraine. It's going to be the same with the case of Israel. We just talked about South Africa. You know, the Gaza issue became the thorny even more than anything else in the relationship between South Africa and the United States. So the many data points that we have to see, things, this world is very dynamic. Things can change very quickly over the next 6 months.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mvemba Phezo-Dizolele, Senior Fellow and Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic International Studies. Focus on Africa was pulled together by the sterling efforts of Stefania Okereke, Nyasha Michelle and Kane Peary here in London. Charles Kitonga toiled from afar in Nairobi. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior producer. Francesca Dunn, the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. By the way, you know we have a sister pod, right? It's called Africa Daily and it's presented by Alan Kasuja. They take a close look at one story a day from the continent. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
I'm Sarah Chalevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter venta.com/horen.